today I'm here with Professor Thomas Seyfried, who is a cancer researcher at Boston College in Boston. So, Professor Seyfried, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Adrian. It's a pleasure to be here.
Can you tell us a little bit about your background and like what you did to become who you are?
Well, I mean, we've been in this business for quite a while, but my main background is in genetics. I received a degree in genetics and lipid biochemistry from the University of Illinois, and then we proceeded to do a lot of work on neurochemistry in the brain of animals with epilepsy and mapping genes and this kind of thing, very complex epilepsies. And we were also at the same time doing studies of brain tumors while I was at Yale University. And, you know, over the years, we were doing basic fundamental stuff. And then we started to do some drug studies on brain tumors, and it became apparent to us that the therapeutic benefits of some of the drugs were linked to actual body weight loss. So the effects that we see on certain drugs was linked more to how much body weight the animal lost when they were taking the drug, because when we put body weight controls in there, take another population of mice, and then just restrict their food intake to match the body weight of the animal on the drug, we basically found the same thing. The size of the tumors were reduced to approximately the same level. And then we began to look at the biochemistry of the tumors, and we found it to be highly the body weight loss was associated with a restriction of blood vessels, which is an anti-angiogenic effect.
Let me just jump in here, because I know this is terrible for an academic, but I'm going to have to simplify this down a little bit, because I understand quite a bit about what you're talking about, but a lot of people won't. So Dr. Seyfried is a researcher who is focused on the ketogenic diet and with relation to cancer. And one of the key things that have you discovered this? No, you're building on research from Otto Warburg and others, basically saying that you can essentially starve cancer by switching cancer patients to a ketogenic diet. And so when you're talking about loss of body weight, that's essentially what you're talking about. Does that sound correct?
Yeah. Well, the issue is, how do we get to that point where we were using ketogenic diets to manage cancer? And the path to get to that spot took us to a variety of different observations on these tumors. And of course, we work in epilepsy, and ketogenic diet was designed originally as a means of controlling very difficult refractory seizures in children. And the mechanism by which this ketogenic diet blocks epilepsy is still a point of considerable discussion and research, because it's not really clear how you take a child that has seizures that are not responsive to drugs, put the child on a ketogenic diet, and oftentimes the seizures will be significantly reduced or disappear altogether. That's the area that started in the 1920s by Dr. Wilder when they were looking at fasting and showing how powerful fasting was in blocking seizures. But of course, that's only temporary. And then they developed this ketogenic diet. So what we did was dovetail this ketogenic diet into the management of cancer, mainly because we found that these body weight losses were associated with reduced glucose and elevated ketones. And if you want to reduce glucose and elevate ketones, the ketogenic diet is the best way to do this. So it became clear that we could have a significant impact on how tumors grow, and look at also the multiple different mechanisms that the cancer industry is investigating through various drugs and immunotherapies and all these kinds of things, and find out that the ketogenic diet does all this, but it does it without toxicity. So, I mean, this now becomes very interesting. Can you manage the disease without toxicity? And the answer is we think it can be.
So, I mean, is this something you came up with, or is this something from Otto Warburg, or where did this come from?
Well, the ketogenic diet, I mean, as I said, came from epilepsy, but Warburg showed that it was the blood glucose that was driving these tumors, and his theory is that the reason why the tumors are so dependent on glucose for their growth and survival is because their mitochondria, the little energy-producing organelle within the cell, is defective. So the cells can't respire effectively because the organelle responsible for respiration is abnormal or insufficient or damaged. There's a whole series of things. So if this happens, the cell, in order to survive, must revert to a primitive form of energy, which is fermentation, and the primary fuel for fermentation is glucose. So this, the ketogenic diet then lowers the glucose and then has the body burn ketones, which normal mitochondria needed to burn ketones. And if the cancer cells have defective respiration, because their mitochondria are defective, they can't effectively burn the ketones. So we have a very nice, elegant system to target and kill tumor cells without toxicity, which is based on Otto Warburg's theory. But Warburg never discussed this in relationship to a ketogenic diet. He probably would have been very excited had he been alive today to see this.
Hmm. He sounds, I read a bit about him, he sounds like he was quite a character.
Oh yeah, he had was a German aristocrat who was quite certain, and he in his observations, and he did numerous experiments over many, many years to support his theory, which has never been disproved. So people can argue whether he was right or not, but his theory, the basic concept that respiration is abnormal with compensatory fermentation, which is referred to as the Warburg effect, that still stands and is becoming more and more investigated now, that that people realize that, you know, we're not making major progress in the genomic analysis or using genomic information to target disease. It's simply not effective. Now people are revisiting the Warburg theory and recognizing that he actually had this thing pegged a long time ago.
Are a lot of people researching this?
Well, I wouldn't say a lot, but I certainly say it's an emerging field. The idea of energy cancer, the studies of cancer energy metabolism is certainly advancing significantly. New journals are starting, and many people are now becoming more aware of it. Although I have to admit, a mainstream academic cancer research is still focused on the gene theory of cancer, and the therapies that are being developed are many of them are linked to the idea that cancer is a genetic disease. So if metabolism is considered, it would be considered an effect of some kind of gene mutation, and what we've done is shown that that's not the case.
Right. So some questions. How long does the cancer take to grow?
Well, it depends on what kind of cancer you're dealing with. You know, in humans, you know, some people could have this could be decades, years. Other situations, depending on the organ and situation, it can happen very quickly. You know, an insult in a particular situation like inflammation, chronic inflammation, may persist for many decades before a neoplasia begins, disorganized, uncontrolled growth. Whereas in other situations, we've seen tumors arise within several months of a lesion or an insult. So it can vary tremendously from one person to the next and from one type of cancer to the next.
So I told you by email beforehand, my father died of pancreatic cancer. I read about that online, and one of the things that they said is that it's looking like pancreatic cancer can take 20 years before it actually surfaces. So in all of that time, it's actually growing. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, well, with the issue of pancreatic cancer is that it can grow without detection for quite some time, unnoticed, and then by the time it is detected, of course, it has already gone to an advanced state, which makes it very very difficult to control. So yes, you know, people, the key thing about managing cancer is everyone kind of knows is that if you catch these tumors early enough and you can surgically resect them without having invasion, a significant invasion into surrounding tissues, I mean, the disease can be cured. I mean, there's no doubt that surgery can can cure cancer if it's caught early enough. If the cells metastasize or spread, then you know you can't surgically resect all these hundreds of different sites that have now sprang up in various parts of the body. So again, surgery can cure the disease if it's caught early enough, and then you know, if it's not, then people use drugs and radiation and this kind of stuff, which may not be effective.
Things that you're not a big fan of.
Well, you know, I don't want to say I'm not a big fan of it. I just want to say that, at least for brain cancer, as far as I can see, radiation of the human brain is not healthy. You know, it's not even if you survive the therapy, many people suffer from all kinds of neurological impairments as the result of having their brain irradiated. The issue is, can you achieve a management of a brain tumor without resorting to a very toxic way to deal with the problem? And the answer is, I think that this can be done if people can realize that there are alternatives to toxic radiation.
Right.
And that's one of the things that I've been working on, my students and I have been working on this for quite some time. But there's a reluctance to get clinical trials going to prove our case without having to first irradiate the person. It's just like, well, you know, it's very hard to do this because the standard of care requires radiation. But radiation itself is tremendously damaging and can also cause tumor, can provoke the tumor.
So even in cases where the person is likely going to die anyway, by the time you get them and can put them on the ketogenic diet to ideally help reduce and maybe even eliminate their cancer, the chemo's already done a lot of damage to them anyway.
Well, they've done a lot. So, you know, I mean, what the trials that are being considered today, for the most part, are those that, okay, we give the patient the standard of care, which is radiation and chemo, which is mostly temozolomide, and the standard of other, you know, steroids and things like this. And then when the tumor recurs, and invariably it does, then we will use this, you know, ketogenic diet, because we know that there's almost zero survival when the brain tumor recurs. So at that point, then people are open to the ketogenic diet because they no longer have anything that will work. The problem is now you're asking this ketogenic diet is a metabolic therapy. You're asking this metabolic therapy now to attempt to correct the incredible damage done by the original first standard of care, and while at the same time now curing tumor. This is a tall order for any kind of a therapy, and it's also used. I mean, even if someone were to have another kind of a therapy other than a ketogenic diet, they still have to use it after the standard of care. Most of these patients have to be treated with the standard of care. And it seems like the standard of care is a locked-in procedure, but it doesn't have to be. I don't know. There seems to be very little flexibility in considering alternatives. Now, patients have to be advised if they would like to use a metabolic therapy as an alternative standard of care. They have to recognize that, you know, we're not this is no guarantee that you're going to survive any better with a metabolic therapy than you will with a standard of care, but there's a lot of evidence to say that you might, and that's the decision, and you don't often get that choice at any of the major hospitals.
So when my father got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer, and we found out something like a month later it had already metastasized, it had already spread to his liver. And they were able to identify it at a very early level, because he was going to be able to have what's known as a Whipple surgery, where they cut it out, but he was too late for that. What would have been the chance that if we'd have put him straight onto a ketogenic diet, that would have made a difference?
Well, I only know of a few pancreatic cancer patients who are on the ketogenic diet right now. But, you know, the ketogenic diet is only one part of the process. In my most recent article in Carcinogenesis, we call it the press pulse strategy for metabolic therapy. The ketogenic diet is the press. So what happens is your whole body is then reconditioned to an alternative fuel, which is ketones. This puts tremendous pressure on the tumor cells in the body, but it doesn't necessarily kill them. It puts them into a more dormant, less aggressive state. But they are vulnerable. They now become vulnerable. And the pulse, which we like to call the hit, hitting these vulnerable cells, we think hyperbaric oxygen, which my colleague Dominic D'Agostino is an expert in, and we work together on this. And we know of a pancreatic cancer patient who had advanced metastatic pancreatic cancer, who has taken the ketogenic diet and hyperbaric oxygen, and at this point seems to be doing well, in the sense that there is regression of metastatic lesions. But this is more of a complete metabolic therapy. The ketogenic diet is only one phase, and then we have these pulses, which could be hyperbaric oxygen, together with a whole array of different kinds of low-dose drugs that can put additional pressure on the surviving cells. How long can these people? We don't know. I mean, this is all new. And the issue here, of course, is that these people who are doing this are not sick, in contrast to the standard of care where people use radiation and chemo and all these toxic interventions. And most of the people on the ketogenic diet are generally pretty healthy. I mean, other than the fact that they have to give up their carbs and things like this, which can be a little bit stressful, but they're not harmed. They're not feeling sick and tired. To the same extent or anywhere near the extent that the standard of care. So how long can a pancreatic cancer patient survive using metabolic therapy as opposed to, say, some toxic immunotherapy or some other kinds of toxic? Because let's be honest, most of the drugs that people are subjected to are extremely toxic. And that's one of the reasons why people fear the cancer, mainly because of the kinds of treatments their bodies have to be subjected to.
No, I mean, my father refused most chemo. He took a little bit at the end. He was an orthopedic surgeon, and he knew exactly what all of those things did. It was actually really interesting. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal that came out around that time about an orthopedic surgeon who refused any drugs when he got cancer, and he just peacefully died. And that's actually essentially the same thing that my father did, who was an orthopedic surgeon of the same age. So I think doctors know this, but patients don't. And
yeah. Well, that's true. I think a lot of I certainly know of some physicians who are actually doing the ketogenic diet themselves to try to battle their own disease. And that's another thing too. When you say, I'm using metabolic therapy and the ketogenic diet to battle my cancer," that's a true statement. Because many people say, "Well, he's battling his cancer. He's really not doing anything but sitting there and getting infused with some sort of toxic chemical or irradiated." And I don't consider that battling your disease. But we're using metabolic therapy is definitely because a lot of this comes as a personal determination to do this. And once your body is in this new state where glucose is lower and ketones are elevated, you know, those tumor cells now become vulnerable to so many other kinds of approaches. And some of these new therapies from the genome projects could potentially be very useful in finishing off surviving tumor cells in some of these patients. The problem now is they're using some of these new therapies as a standalone or a first line of defense or a first line of attack. And the tumor is so genetically heterogeneous, this stuff doesn't work, except, you know, you might live another few months at an enormous cost. But I would like, it would in our writings, and what we say is that these things could be effective as the final chapter in controlling your disease, because now you have a much smaller tumor with a very few number of cells that may all express the same marker, and now these guys become very vulnerable, these surviving tumor cells, to these personalized genetic therapies. But the personalized genetic therapies don't work as an upfront, they don't work well as an upfront first line of attack on the majority of people that are treated. So I think that we need to reevaluate what we have to treat the disease and the timing and how we apply this to the patients. And this is what I think is lacking in the cancer field today.
Has the incidence of cancer increased over the last 50 years? I know in the past people would die and we'd say that they died of indigestion, which is obviously a little bit vague. But do you think it – I mean, my grandparents all lived into their late 80s, and it seems like a lot of people now are dying in their 60s.
Well, you know, it's hard to say. I mean, I have the data in my book where I've looked at the number of new cases are certainly increasing every year. There's no question about it. And I've even linked the percentage increase of new cases each year to the percentage of increase in cancer research funding. The percentage increase in funding parallels the percentage increase in new cancer cases. What is interesting, though, is the number of deaths per year or deaths per day hasn't really changed in more than 20 years. So now people say, well, that's a really good thing because your increase of new cases is not parallel with the number of deaths, which would mean we have no advances in the field. But the fact that the number of deaths per year have not really changed, their percentage increase is much less than the percentage increase of new cases. That's the way you interpret bad news in a good way. But 570,000 Americans dying each year of cancer I wouldn't consider that any level of success. Although if you want to look at the differences, the number of new cases is greater than the number of deaths, percentage increase is. So you're saying, oh, well, we're making some advances. You know, I mean, give me a break. This is not now, and the other thing too, of course, is that, you know, yes, there's more people being diagnosed with cancer. There's more people being treated with cancer. And you know, many of these treatments themselves will lead to secondary cancers later on in life. So, and other adverse effects. In fact, there's new clinics opening up now just to deal with the millions of so-called cancer survivors who are now suffering from all kinds of maladies that they never had before they had cancer. So these maladies are the result of the treatments, not necessarily the disease.
What kind of maladies?
Well, I think 70% of people who have been treated with chemo and cancer depression is like very, very high in survivors. And then there's also gastrointestinal issues, neurological issues. There's bone issues. There's a whole series of various maladies that people, cardiovascular disease. There's the whole spectrum of different kinds of ailments that we see in people who actually say, well, I'm a cancer survivor, but you don't get out of this completely unscathed. And many, you know, 10 to 20 years after the treatments, there's recurrent cancers that could occur in the same tissue or in a different tissue.
That's a real part of your line of work, isn't it?
Yeah.
there's just not much good news about it.
I mean, we see, I mean, the numbers are there. This is all, if you really want to know the situation, look at the Wall Street Journal. They give you a different kind of perspective. They're interested primarily in the profits that some of these approaches will generate. Not so necessarily interested in whether it cures anybody, but what the profit margin is. And you can get a real feel for, you know, the company stocks going up and down as the drugs are the optimistic attitude towards the drug when it's first launched, and then to have it taken off the market because the effects are worse than the disease. So, and then you see the profits go down. So it's clearly, you can see the influence of the effects of cancer on the profits of these very.
Well, it's capitalism. Capitalism is a monster that, you know, does a lot of good and does some bad as well, and we've just got to manage it somehow.
Well, our view is that we think we can do this. The problem, of course, is that our way of using metabolic therapy, how people are now trying to figure out how they can profit on it, I guess you want to say. I mean, we're interested more in it, if it works or not. We think it will. And now investors or people who are looking at this wondering, you know, is there any way that we could make profit on this? And, you know, one of our views is, of course, you know, hyperbaric oxygen is a therapy that could potentially replace radiation therapy. It certainly kills the tumor cells the same way radiation does. So, it causes reactive oxygen species. And if it can kill the cancer cells the same way radiation does without toxicity, then this could be a nice non-toxic substitute for that form of therapy. Now, we need a lot of research to support this, but we think it can happen based on the way that some patients are responding to it with ketogenic diet. And there's the food industry seems to be interested in these ketogenic diet approaches because it's not just for cancer. I mean, this ketogenic diet, it causes a general overall body health. there are a number of people doing it for weight loss, for their general health and wealth.
I mean, I'm doing it for weight loss. I'm doing the ketogenic diet, as we just mentioned before the call. I'm doing it fairly poorly at the moment, but working on getting better at it. And essentially what you're doing is making your fat as the primary food source instead of carbs, or the primary energy source for the body. And so, you know, I'm working to get to get fat as being something like 85% of my energy. And that's difficult. And I've made sort of the standard beginner mistakes of overeating on protein. When I'd drop carbs, I'd increase protein to compensate. And that gave me kidney problems and went to the doctor and had to go to the hospital and all sorts of things. And so I had to sort of really try to figure out what the hell I was doing, because, you know, I didn't know.
You're absolutely right, Adrian. I mean, if you do this the wrong way, it's not healthy. And in fact, I've written that many times. And when we gave our metastatic mouse models the ketogenic diet, and some ketogenic diets and unrestricted amounts, that the cancers got worse. You have to know how to use this. This is a therapy. This is a medical therapy that you need to know a lot about, physicians. And this is one of the problems. There's not that many people trained to help people use the ketogenic diet in a healthy way.
This Beth, who is at the Charlie Institute, who seems like she's like the goddess of the ketogenic diet.
Yes, she is. She trains a lot of physicians and nurses. And
she can't get hit by a bus or anything anytime soon, because if we lose her, we're screwed, I think.
She's really the best. And now she's taking on a lot of cancer patients. And, you know, we're learning a little bit different, though. The cancer patients, they already, you know... If you go on a ketogenic diet, people that are not suffering from the disease seem to get into the ketosis and low glucose faster than the cancer patients. And we're learning a lot about the differences between people who want to use this metabolic therapy for weight loss and health, and people who want to use the same therapy for killing their cancer cells, or at least arresting the growth or managing the disease. And this is an interesting physiological difference between the cancer patient and the normal patient. And we're just beginning to learn about this. So it's taking cancer patients sometimes a little bit longer to get into the zones, these so-called metabolic new homeostatic.
Well, which would make sense. They're sick.
Yeah, but they're not only – the tumor cells have a tendency to maintain elevated blood glucose. And we think this is through some cachectic mechanisms. We're using metabolizing the person's own proteins in the body. To keep a steady or higher level of glucose, which is needed by the tumor. So the tumor is then using some resources of the body to maintain its glucose levels, and we need to put pressure on that. So I noticed that from my experience with humans. Of course, we've done a lot of work with mice. We noticed that it can take 4 to 6 months of steady diligence to get the body into a consistently stable homeostatic state for a cancer patient, where this can happen in about 3 to 4 weeks with a non-cancer patient.
Do you eat the ketogenic diet yourself?
Well, you know, I've had it. I mean, it's certainly, you know, coconut oils and MCT oils. I've certainly had the Bulletproof coffee, and so have my students. You know, we made it up in my cancer class just to let everybody know that it's quite palatable. It consists of butter and medium chain triglyceride oil and little coconut oil, you know, put into a blender and mixed with a fresh pot of organic coffee. And, you know, you can throw a little of stevia in there to give it a sweetener. We didn't use that, but it was like a latte. So it was a white foamy kind of stuff, and it wasn't bad at all. Now, a lot of people are using this to lose weight, but the cancer patients are using it also to lower their glucose and elevate their ketones.
So in terms of diet yourself, are you eating the standard American diet, or are you eating a low-carb diet?
No, I mean, I don't have cancer. If I were to – I'm not battling a weight issue. But I have done it. I've gone on fasts just to see, you know, if I'm telling people, you know, you should go on a fast. As my wife says, why don't you try it? So I said, okay, my students and I have tried it. So we've done, you know, 3 to 4 day fasts, you know, just water alone, no juicing, nothing, just water or green tea, you know, not decaffeinated green tea, which is no carbs at all, no calories and nothing. So we know what it's like. You know, the question is, of course, if I were to have cancer, any kind of a cancer, the first thing I would do would be to do to do exactly. I wouldn't do any of this toxic chemo stuff. I wouldn't do any of this stuff. I would use metabolic therapy and apply everything that I know to manage the disease that I have. And I would never subject myself to radiation. Unless I were like 90 years old, you know, sometimes a radiation, that's why older people who are in their 80s or 90s are given the radiation option, because they're not going to live long enough to get a secondary tumor. So,
right. I mean, the reason I ask about diet is because, do you not feel that it's actually very possible that the one of the fundamental causes of all of this cancer, it may actually be the amount of carbs that we're eating?
Yeah, well, you know, this is another thing that I've written in my book, you know, cancer prevention. Okay, so people can go on a sustained ketogenic diet day in and day out. And some of my friends, I have people that I know who do this. They're, you know, they're using a very paleolithic. I think this paleolithic diet is very healthy. These are good conscious choices for maximum health benefits. Or people who, well, they say, well, I can't be doing this my whole life. You know, some people just feel that, you know, they've got to go to Ruth Chris's and get a big steak and eat a big, you know, they're not going to take themselves out of the mainstream. So for those kinds of people, you know, doing a periodic fast, you know, for 3 to 4 days, a couple of times a year, can be very healthy in rejuvenating mitochondrial function. Because as long as you can keep the mitochondria in those cells healthy, the probability of getting cancer is extremely low. Now, ketogenic diet will do this. This is why, you know, if you're on a ketogenic diet, the probability of getting cancer while on the diet is the risk is much, much lower than if you're not on the diet. On the other hand, if you want to try to, you know, help yourself for a short period of time, you can do a water-only therapeutic fast a couple of times a year. And then this will enhance the functionality of the mitochondria and prevent significantly reduce the risk of cancer. So people have these choices. There's not just one way to prevent cancer. There's many ways to prevent cancer. You know, diet and exercise are critical. But on the other hand, if you have cancer, sometimes people over-exercise. This is another thing I wrote in my book. I mean, they go out and they, oh, I got to run it, you know, 10 miles. I got this cancer. I got to run it out of my body. Counterproductive. So, again, one has to know what is your goal and the procedure by which you can accomplish this goal. And if you know these kinds of things, you're going to be much healthier.
But couldn't we just suggest that, given the fact that the ketogenic diet, which is essentially a high-fat diet, is so successful in treating cancer, that probably we're eating too much carbs, and that therefore the cause of a lot of this cancer? I mean, I know in your book you talk about, for example, cell phones, but in fact the cause of a lot of these cancers may actually just be the general high-carb diet, which has evolved over the last 50 years, like post-civil rights movement. Before that, all of our grandparents would eat, you know, gladly, you know, chow down a lot of bacon and eggs and a lot of things like that.
Yeah, there's no question. I mean, it's not the linkage between the diet and what we're exposed to. It's the environment and things has changed dramatically over the last, 30 years. You know, we've introduced a lot of high fructose corn syrup into the food industry. You know, a lot of empty calories, a lot of high carbohydrate sugars in all of our foods. There's no question that this is having an impact. There's significant linkages between hemoglobin A1, and which is a marker for elevated glucose, consistent and the risk of certain kinds of cancers, diabetes and cancer. I mean, Alzheimer's disease. Now, interestingly enough, the Alzheimer's is a very interesting point, because apparently, if you have Alzheimer's disease, the risk of cancer is much less. And we were grappled with this for quite some time. So, you know, what is it about if you have Alzheimer's disease, your risk for cancer is much lower. And what we found is that the people who have Alzheimer's are actually hypometabolic. They have fewer glucose transporters on their cells. And they can't, you can't drive, if glucose is driving your cancer and you can't bring the glucose into the cell, for whatever reason, you're not going to be able to develop a cancer very effectively. Now, we don't understand this. We don't understand. But Alzheimer's disease is a different kind of metabolic disorder. Cancer is one kind of metabolic disorder. Alzheimer's disease is another. But they seem to be potentially on the opposite poles. So again, can you treat Alzheimer's disease with a ketogenic diet? And the answer is yes. Mary Newport wrote a nice book on this, showing how coconut oil, and there's been a lot of evidence to support this. So, but it works. It also works by stimulating mitochondria in some of these cells of the Alzheimer's patients, whereas in cancer, the tumor cells can't use the ketones, so they become marginalized. So we have to think of the different kinds of mechanisms by which these same therapies work against one disease versus another.
Does it work with dementia as well, or just Alzheimer's?
Well, we're talking about dementia now. Alzheimer's dementia. We haven't looked at any. I don't know if there's any case studies of the brain in patients who have been on ketogenic diets who have had improved cognitive behavior, and then to try to correlate that. It's hard to know the level of plaques and tangles in your brain. What impact that might have had. You can do that with animal models and things like this, but it would be tough for people. We do know that the ketogenic diet can improve the cognitive behavior of certain people with Alzheimer's disease. So clearly there's a link there, although it's not widely accepted. I think people want drugs that are going to do this. Unfortunately, many of the drugs for Alzheimer's disease are toxic, like many of the drugs for cancer. So
at least in what I'm seeing is people are starting to want to move away from drugs, and if we can do things naturally, that's better. It would seem to, a conversation, because my mother's not wildly excited that I'm doing the ketogenic diet, and she's been telling me that I should eat a balanced diet. I've got an interest in a lot of history, and particularly ancient Roman history. And one of the interesting things about ancient Rome is their fruits that they had back then were things like dates and figs. Apples and tomatoes and things like that didn't arrive until Christopher Columbus went over to the Americas. And so it seems like our diet has changed a lot. And my suspicion is that what we're referring to with the ketogenic diet is the diet that the Neanderthals were eating 10,000 years ago that's probably the most healthy for the human body.
Yeah, well, I think that's when we say healthy, we also have to be careful about this, because a lot of these ancients were also suffering from certain kinds of malnutritions. They had a lot of arthritis, and there was a lot of other issues. However, you're right about the Eskimos, Inuits didn't have very many vegetables or fruits. They're mostly blubber and whale meat and this kind of stuff, and that diet was more of an Atkins. And that's the ketogenic diet is less protein than an Atkins. And people say, Atkins diet, hasn't worked against cancer. But Atkins diet is not a ketogenic diet.
Right.
And the Atkins diet is heavy into protein and fat and also low carb, whereas the ketogenic diet is heavy into fat and has much lower protein content. And it's important to do a correct kind of ketogenic diet that is nutritionally balanced. You can have a nutritionally balanced ketogenic diet that can be extremely healthy for you. It's when you get when you attempt to do the ketogenic diet that's out of balance with respect to nutrients. You can supplement.
and that's what I've done. You mentioned in your book, you talk about supplements, and you talk about taking a calcium supplement and not a potassium supplement. And I'm wondering why that might be.
Well, it's not yet clear about this, because when people salts, I would say salts are important to increase your salt, because what happens when your ketone levels go up into the 3 to 4 to 5, sometimes 6 millimolar range, there's the urination increases and you kind of deplete your body of some electrolytes. So it's important to maintain electrolyte balance, and people who are in ketosis. Healthy ketosis, not ketoacidosis, which is a pathological, very dangerous pathological condition. But healthy ketosis, you should have a balance of increased salt. And all this stuff is counterintuitive. You say, wow, geez, I'm eating fat and salt, and how can you get healthy if you eat a lot of fat and salt? Well, the question is, you're not eating a lot of it. You're eating a small amount of it. And people go overboard on these ketogenic diets. Their total caloric intake increases. And if you eat too much ketogenic diet, it can be very unhealthy, like a lot of things. The whole thing is keeping a low total caloric intake and the correct nutrient balance, and with micronutrients and macronutrients. But the predominant fuels are fats.
Well, the trick is also with the ketogenic diet is you can eat more, but it takes away hunger. It really does, and the difference is astounding. And when my mother was staying with me here in New York, she eats a lot of carbs. I just started doing it then, and it was really noticeable that she had to eat every couple of hours, and I didn't. And my mother's really thin and in good shape, but she's hooked on her carbs. And
well, I said in my book also. I mean, we have it's glucose addiction. And when you pull yourself off carbs, I mean, the malaise and the headaches and all these kinds of things that people feel when they transition from carbs to fats is nothing more than a withdrawal. It's any more than you would if you were on drugs or alcohol or cigarettes. It's a withdrawal symptom. And the brain neurons love glucose, and glucose comes from carbs. And the more carbs you give your body, the happier your brain is. And trying to withdraw this, but it only lasts for a few days. As you said, once you get into
my brain is much clearer now that I've cut out carbs. So I think I disagree with that statement.
Yeah. Well, I mean I'm talking about the transition from carbs to keto. Once you're in the zone, yes, you will experience what you are experiencing, and how long it takes. People always ask me, well, how long will it take me to get into your zone, Adrian? Well, it depends. It's a very personal, individual thing, I should say. And one individual can get into this zone, and some people have no problem transitioning. Other people struggle tremendously. So again, it's a very individual thing, and we learned this from our cancer patients as well.
Can you talk a little bit about respiration in cancer? Because you talk about that a lot in your book, and I didn't completely understand it. I mean, you're essentially saying that the cancer breathes?
Yeah, well, our normal body cells breathe. I mean, we breathe in oxygen and we exhale CO2, and the CO2 is basically from blown out from the foods that we ate, the carbons that we ate, and the oxygen comes in, and we generate a lot of energy in the mitochondria, the energy power plants within our cells. These little organelles are very efficient in processing energy. And what happens in the tumor cells is that this organelle is damaged or is deficient or has all these issues. So they cannot use oxygen as effectively for generating energy as can normal cells. And that's their common malady. And this is, you know, when people say cancer is many different diseases, it's in one way it is on the surface, but at the core, it's all the same disease. They all have the same respiratory deficiency. And this was Warburg's central theory. The reason why cells ferment and use glucose is because their respiration is defective. If their respiration were normal, they would never need to be using all this excess glucose. So the respiratory system of the cell is damaged, and this is the way the ketogenic diet. This essentially is the reason why the ketogenic diet can work, is because the respiration of the tumor cells is less efficient than the respiration of normal cells, and we take advantage of that. And you need good mitochondria to burn these ketones for energy. Our normal cells, like you said, people who do the ketogenic diet, their normal cells are all transitioned over to these ketones. This makes these little mitochondria in our cells very, very energy efficient and very, very healthy. So the normal cells get very healthy on ketogenic diets. The tumor cells get very taxed and targeted by the ketogenic diet. So it's a whole different way the cells. Now, some people say, well, can you re-educate the cancer cell to become a normal cell? Well, if they have some level of mitochondrial function in those cells, then it is possible that they could be restored to a normal state. On the other hand, there are many cancer cells that have very few, if any, mitochondria, and this has been shown by some investigators. These cells are gone. I mean, the only solution to these cells is to kill them. We're not going to try to re-educate them. They don't have the capacity to be re-educated or to join the society of cells. So we exterminate those cells through these metabolic therapies, and we do it non-toxically. And this is what's interesting about this. Now, to know how this works, I mean, you have to have the correct – why we do all this stuff, or how we learned a lot about this, is we have certain animal models that we developed here at Boston College that are very closely replicating the natural system that we see in the human body with respect to the disease state. So we use the disease in its natural host to learn a lot about this, metastatic cancer, how we can challenge all this. The insight that you get from the good tool allows us to translate that information directly to the clinic And that's what we're seeing. This is why we work. We have a connection between the lab and the clinic directly. So when people ask me about such a compound or this, we test it on the animals first, say, oh, it really works well. No, it doesn't have any effect. And then we can make a more informed decision about how we go after this or tax the respiration or these variety of approaches that we use.
In your book, you talk about the testing and the caging costs with relation to animals. Can you talk a little bit about that and some of the problems you've been seeing?
Well, that's a real issue in the entire biomedical industry here. Many of my colleagues, they're shutting a lot of people out of doing any kind of research in the natural world because the animal charges from the universities become so prohibitively high that you can't do a lot of the work because the animals are costing so much money. I don't think a lot of people realize that. You know, one of the things here at Boston College when I first came here from Yale is there were no animal charges because, you know, our mission is to teach and train undergraduates, and this was part of the training mission. It only became later recognized that if universities charge for these mice, they can make more money for the overhead. And this now cripples, and then the rules and regulations like that come down from the NIH about all this kind of stuff about the animals, and most of this is nonsense. It just cripples the ability to set up the kinds of systems that will allow us to do what we need to do. The novel models that we develop for systemic metastatic cancer, which is the real problem in the majority of people who have cancers, the systemic metastasis. We developed those models here without an animal charge because I was raising thousands of mice to define the few that develop these kinds of rare kinds of conditions. And then once we found them, we were able to exploit this and develop the tool to its maximum advantage. But had we had all these charges, there would be no way. None of what I'm talking about in my book would have existed with the prohibitive charges of animals. It only became later. Now we're all, like all the rest of the universities, we're yoked and restricted in how we can do these kinds of studies. We're very limited in what we can do because of these charges and the costs. You just can't write those charges into your grant. It's just it becomes the singular biggest expense in the grant. So it's really choking the ability of investigators to make major headroads in this.
So let me put this theory past you. Capitalism is an untamed monster, and this is what it's always going to be. And capitalism has a bigger incentive to produce carbs because they're cheap, they can be easily shipped, they can be easily produced, all of these kinds of things. The amount of calories you can get in carbs is higher and cheaper than and can be delivered more easily than anything else. So capitalism has an incentive towards carbs. I believe that academia, with a liberal or left-wing academia, would prefer us to approach the world in more of a green type manner of being more towards vegetarian or vegan or these kinds of things rather than a high-fat type diet. You're explaining the issues that you're facing with caging the animals and testing them and all of these kinds of things. I believe that academia has failed us and that it's not protecting us from capitalism and that we should be eating more of a low-carb diet and there should be more of this testing going on. What do you think of that statement?
Well, I think, this is an important – you're raising a very important issue here. I don't know if I can put it into the issue of capitalism or something like this. I think a lot of the rules, the regulations and these kinds of things and the number of administrators, I think, this has been a real concern. The number of academicians, the guys that are actually in the trenches doing the work, hasn't really changed that. What we've done is put so many more, and this is an issue in higher academics, so many more administrators have been added to our staffs, and who somebody has to pay these guys. And we're increasing administrators faster than we're increasing the actual people that are getting the job done, teaching the students or doing the research. And I know that's very controversial.
No, I mean, and I understand this, but academia has been telling us, along with the U.S. government, that we should eat a low-fat diet. that's been the message. And then you're also seeing that you're being blocked from being able to cage animals properly and do this testing. To me, this is an ideological problem.
Well, I don't know, but I think there's a number of investigators who've come out clearly. I think you have federal regulations and government regulations, and some of these are made, you know, from certain government agencies. And then there are a number of academics that are having that have data that show very different results. I mean, you can talk about the cholesterol issue. You know, everybody should be taking statins. I mean, that's this is not the case. I mean, if you look at the linkage, there's a lot of ambiguity in the linkage between cholesterol and heart disease. It seems to be closer linked to glucose and triglycerides. And
right.
We and others have shown this. Yet, you know, so again, I'm not saying that I wouldn't say that. High carb. You're talking about the food pyramid. Well, the food pyramid is based on a lot of consensus and information, which is under a considerable evaluation, reevaluation, reanalysis. You know, yet edicts are put out and say, "Oh, everybody should do this." Well, that's not necessarily the case. And I'm not saying that the ketogenic diet, eating a high fat diet, is the best for all people. Now, you know that we use it,
but it might be.
It might be, but it's we evolved to like sweet things too. That's the reason why our industry has developed to provide all these sweet empty calories. But in reality, you're right. We came from a Paleolithic ancestry where these kinds of carbs were not in the system, not anywhere near the amount. I mean, where would you get a carb? A ripe banana, a ripe piece of fruit would have the sweetness that you need. Honey, you know, a few things like this. But now we've infused all this stuff into the foods to make almost everything has sugar in it of some one form or another. And you're right. This is now an issue that people have to realize. There's a balance. I think the key thing is we're getting away from the key balance, and that disturbance of the balance is in some way contributing to the higher risk of not only cancer, but, you know, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease, cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes. You can go on. And I think you're right. I mean, but this, so the capitalism of putting carbs into the foods has created a situation which is unhealthy. So now we have an industry that develops around producing drugs rather than going to the cause and saying, okay, let's reevaluate the diets. No, we're going to make a whole series of drugs that are going to individually treat all these different diseases, which potentially have a common origin with an imbalance in the amount of carbs in the food.
And then capitalism is doing what it always does, which is to make money. But the people we rely to protect us from this stuff is academia. They're the ones to warn us against capitalism, and they haven't. And I think that's not okay.
I don't know. I think that the professor from Harvard who identified the trans fats has done an excellent job in alerting people to the removal of trans fats from the diets. His name escapes me right now, but he certainly has blown the whistle on that. People in the tobacco industry, the academics have clearly shown that a lot of this is addicting and this kind of thing. So, I mean, I don't know if, you know, it's in some cases, yes, in other cases, no. I think, you know, most academics like myself and others were interested in knowing the truth about a phenomenon. And I think that, you know, we're still, we're trying to figure out whether a ketogenic diet, a metabolic therapy, can be as effective in managing a very difficult disease as the standard of care. Now, I don't know how to make a profit on this. I only know how to test the idea and determine whether or not we are right. I'm not going to go out and tell everybody that they should be on a ketogenic diet. But I certainly would like to know whether this approach is effective in managing a very complicated disease. And that's important to know that. Then policy issues, people's decisions, all that other stuff will come into play. But I personally like to know if this is a form of successful treatment for a complicated disease that doesn't have to cause toxicity. And I think that's important to know. And I, as an academic, I think I'd like to know the truth on this. Now, if it has repercussions and it has benefits to the population and people can find a way to make it through, make money on it through a capitalistic idea, that's great. But, you know, that's not my main concern at this point.
Understood. And I can just say that, you know, as anecdotally having fairly poorly adopted the ketogenic diet, the things that I've noticed is that my allergies have been massively reduced. And I noticed it just when I was on the plane the other day. I felt like my body was running cooler almost, and I didn't understand what that meant. And then I later looked up and found out that inflammation drops a lot. And so I would have to guess that I had some sort of inflammation before that went away. And this was all brand new for me. So
it could have also been the fact that you might have been taking in less calories as well. You know, I mean, even though it's in fat, you could be taking less calories. It's hard to say why you felt, but what you're feeling is, I have heard many other people express the same kinds of things to me. You go through a number of different, basically you feel better.
I mean, you can try
to figure out why, what part of you, if your physiology is responsible for why you feel better, but a lot of times you do. And what you're saying is very important, because if you go to some cancer websites, the first thing they say, oh, the ketogenic diet could be harmful. And, you know, I'm saying, well, I know a lot of people, yourself included, that find that that's not necessarily the case. You know, so so all this information needs to come out. People need to be more aware of this information so they can make their own decisions.
Very good. Well, is there anything else you'd like to tell us before we wrap up?
No, I think we covered a lot of interesting areas, and you know, we could go on, but I think people can get an idea of what we're doing here, you know, our approach to this very difficult problem. And I've written a number of papers. We've just had another major paper accepted for those of it who might be interested in learning more about the mechanisms involved and the approach that we're taking. I'm hopeful for the future of cancer. I think this is a disease that can be managed effectively without toxicity. You know, possibly at a much lower cost than is presently experienced. So I'm optimistic in that regard.
Awesome. Well, Professor Seyfried, thank you very much for the interview.
Thank you.